Today is Tuesday, October 6th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump is out of the hospital and back at the White House, but his condition is still uncertain.
This week is really, really critical. The doctors are stressed.
A pandemic warning for the coming months from the World Health Organization. Also ahead, Bruce Springsteen, the boss, is about to drop not just a new album, but something a little extra. It's all on today's International Edition. President Trump was discharged Monday evening from the hospital where he was being treated for COVID-19. His condition remains unclear, and outside experts warn that his case may be serious. Trump has released a series of videos in an effort to reassure the public. Trump's doctor, Navy Commander Sean Connolly, was also very upbeat in an afternoon briefing Monday.
Though he may not entirely be out of the woods yet, the team and I agree that all our evaluations, and most importantly, his clinical status, support the president's safe return home, where he'll be surrounded by world-class medical care 24/7.
Trump's return comes as the scale of the outbreak within the White House itself is being uncovered. Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany announced she had tested positive for the virus Monday morning and was entering quarantine. Joining us now is White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, what's the latest?
Well, Lori, the president got off of Marine One on the South Lawn. He walked towards the residence, turned to the cameras. I yelled a few questions at him over the sound of the helicopter engines, and in response to my question of how do you feel, he replied, real good, and then walked up the stairs of the South Portico, stood on the Truman balcony, removed his mask, saluted the Marine One helicopter, and then walked inside. And immediately after that, he recorded a video, which was released on Monday evening on Twitter, where the president told Americans regarding the coronavirus, don't be afraid of it. And then remarked about his own recovery and how well he was feeling after 72 hours in the hospital and said, maybe I'm immune. I don't know.
What else do we know? Do we know what kind of care he's under? Do we know if he's still on all these medications? Is there any indication as to his prognosis or?
There's no doubt, Lori, that at this moment, the president is still in the progression of this disease, no matter how he says he feels, that he is still shedding the virus. He is contagious, and he needs to be protected because of the medication that he is on that could affect his immune system, and he needs to protect others. You talk to any doctor, and they will tell you that. Now, him coming back to the White House, checking out of the military hospital, which is what Walter Reed is in Bethesda, Maryland, is different than you or me going home from the hospital. The White House essentially has a mini theater, and he will have all sorts of doctors, nurses, and other medical practitioners looking after him around the clock, presumably for the next week, until it is deemed that he is no longer shedding virus, that all of his vitals are fine, and that it's okay, according to the doctors, for him to get back out on the campaign trail and show up at that second debate against former Vice President Joe Biden.
Is there any indication as to the time frame as to when doctors feel like enough time will have passed when they will be confident he's out of the woods for getting sicker and being contagious?
That usually comes between 10 days and 2 weeks into the disease. And there's a little bit of a question as to just how many days in we are with Donald Trump and the coronavirus because he first tested a positive for COVID-19 last Thursday. So presumably he may have been infected with the virus several days before that. But what the doctors have said at Walter Reed is that 7 to 10 days in is really potentially the most dangerous period. And the president has not reached that quite yet. So this week is really, really critical. The doctors have stressed that he's not out of the woods yet.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman, thanks so much. Well, President Trump's coronavirus infection has put the presidential campaign focus back on the pandemic in the United States, which continues to lead the world in the number of infections. Now, more than 7.4 million and deaths at over 209,000, according to Johns Hopkins University. VOA's Brian Patton reports that voter reaction across the country has been mixed, with many feeling sympathy for the president, but many others also blaming him for downplaying the seriousness of the pandemic and for his failure to follow public health protocols.
Over the weekend, President Trump's supporters gathered outside of Walter Reed Military Medical Center in suburban Maryland as the president was undergoing coronavirus treatment to wish him a speedy recovery.
He's strong. He's a fighter. So I have every hope. But, I mean, obviously, they need to take every precaution.
On Sunday, supporters cheered as Trump briefly emerged from the hospital to wave at the crowd from his motorcade. But some medical experts raised concerns that two Secret Service agents were riding in the vehicle with the infected president. A new Reuters poll indicates the outpouring of concern for the president's well-being may not have helped his re-election campaign, with Democratic candidate Joe Biden increasing his lead nationally to 10 percentage points over Trump. And in the same poll, nearly two-thirds of respondents thought the president, who has held crowded events and mocked the wearing of masks, probably would not have been infected if he had taken the virus more seriously. Across the country, voters critical of the president have tempered their concern for his health with harsh criticism for what they see as his reckless behavior. In Wisconsin,
I don't want the man to die from it, and I know he's starting to show symptoms, but I hope he gets a good case of it so he understands how people are suffering and dying and realize how serious it really is.
And in Virginia, where early voting in the presidential election has already begun.
On the one hand, people may feel sympathetic toward him. On the other hand, people may think it's ironic since he's been so anti-mask and all of that.
For its part, the Trump campaign defends the president's efforts to limit the pandemic's impact on the economy.
We can't all just stay in our basement for the rest of our lives. We have to get out there and live our lives and take this on, develop the vaccine, develop more therapeutics, and defeat it.
While the Trump campaign has been mostly sidelined as he recuperates from COVID-19, Biden continues to hold a mix of socially distanced and virtual events where he underscores the seriousness of the pandemic. And with the election just weeks away and an estimated 3 million ballots already cast in early voting and by mail, Trump has a narrow window to make up for lost time on the campaign trail. Brian Padden, VOA News, Washington.
At a campaign event Monday in Miami, Florida, Democrat Joe Biden wished the president well, but expressed his ongoing concern about the continuing spread of coronavirus.
This week, at least 5,000 more will die. Cases and deaths are climbing in many states. I hope the president's recovery is swift and successful, but our nation's COVID crisis is far from over.
Biden has been careful not to criticize Trump, but also made clear he will continue campaigning. The renewed effort in the U.S. Congress to reach a fresh deal to pump coronavirus relief funds into the pandemic-hit economy has been further complicated by President Trump's illness and, as Reuters reporter Fred Katayama tells us, now that three Senate Republicans have also tested positive.
That has led Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to announce his Senate will be out for 2 weeks, suggesting a deal is not imminent. His counterpart in the Congress, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, had just spent a week in daily talks with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin trying to negotiate a bipartisan aid package aimed at helping those suffering economically from the pandemic. Lawmakers from both parties agree on the need for more stimulus. But no new relief has been passed since March, when Congress and the White House approved more than $3 trillion worth of coronavirus relief measures. The Democrats and the Trump administration are about $600 billion apart on the size of a proposed package. And the Democrats insist on a $600 weekly pandemic jobless benefit, $200 more than the administration's offer. Bipartisan support is necessary for any bill to pass, but hurdles remain. Some moderate Democrats in the democratically controlled House who are running for re-election in swing states want a deal before Election Day, while some Republicans in the Republican-controlled Senate are not eager to pass a massive spending bill. On Sunday, Pelosi told a Sunday political talk show, "We're making progress." But it's unclear just how involved Trump will be behind the scenes while he's ill.
Reuters' Fred Katayama reporting. The World Health Organization says the coronavirus pandemic could be increasingly difficult in the coming months. At a news conference Monday, WHO top emergency expert Michael Ryan said outbreaks are surging in parts of Southeast Asia, along with a rise in deaths in parts of Europe and the Eastern Mediterranean region.
Our current best estimates tell us that about 10% of the global population may have been infected by this virus. This varies depending on country, it varies from urban to rural, it varies between different groups. But what it does mean is that the vast majority of the world remains at risk.
The figure indicates we could see worldwide more than 20 times the number of confirmed cases so far. Azerbaijan and Armenia accused each other on Monday of attacking civilian areas as the deadliest fighting in the South Caucasus region for more than 25 years has killed scores of people on both sides. NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg joined in the calls for an immediate end to the clashes over Nagorno-Karabakh, a mountain enclave that belongs to Azerbaijan under international law, but is populated and governed by ethnic Armenians. VOA Middle East correspondent and Istanbul Bureau Chief Heather Murdoch just arrived in the Armenian capital of Yerevan and joins us for a brief update. Heather, thank you for being with us. This is a decades-old conflict, but this new flare-up seems to be especially worrisome.
Well, a lot of people I've talked to here and on the other side believe that this conflict, while it's been going on for decades, this particular time, it's possibly becoming a war that will last a long time. And it's been quite violent. Residents are telling me that refugees are already arriving in the capital over here in Armenia, and businesses are already starting to either fail or lose a lot of revenue, and they're already suffering because of the coronavirus pandemic. And apparently, some areas of the conflict zone are already devastated. One young man was telling me today that he's trying to help out families that are arriving here and trying to place them in temporary homes because their homes have just been destroyed.
And we have a serious refugee crisis growing really in many, many parts of the world right now. And of course, with the coronavirus, as you mentioned, that just makes it all the more difficult. Is it a concern as to where these people will actually be able to go if this continues to escalate?
If it continues to escalate, it is a really difficult situation, not just here, but everywhere, because refugees have fewer places to go with borders closed and countries in general not willing to take new people for fear of the virus. As of now, refugees, I mean, technically, legally, they are internally displaced people. And actually, even as I say that, it's a disputed area. So to call them refugees or internally displaced people would be something for a lawyer to decide what to call them. However, people leaving their homes from this area at this point are not such a large number that they're trying to flee the country and have no place to go. They're being displaced within Armenia. However, if it continues, another refugee crisis coming out of this region would strain a refugee system that is already at the breaking point.
If, as you say, this looks like it could actually be an extended situation of unrest, what will that mean for neighboring countries and how concerned are they?
Countries in the region are very concerned. And in some ways, this conflict looks like it could escalate more than prior conflicts about the same region because neighboring countries are involved. And it appears almost like an extension of other proxy wars in Libya and in Syria. And countries on both sides that support both Azerbaijan and Armenia have come out loudly in the press saying they will support the other side. And there have been some reports of foreign fighters in this battle so far. But the main concern is if it becomes yet another proxy war between major regional powers, that's what has people the most worried.
VOA Middle East correspondent and Istanbul Bureau Chief Heather Murdoch in Yerevan, Armenia. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi warns the coronavirus pandemic is posing unparalleled challenges and threats to refugee protection at a time when conflicts are flaring up in many parts of the world. As Lisa Schlein reports for VOA, the High Commissioner was speaking at the opening of the agency's annual executive committee meeting in Geneva.
The conference is opening in the midst of a pandemic that has infected more than 35 million people and killed more than 1 million. UNHCR Chief Filippo Grandi says so far major outbreaks in large refugee settings have been prevented, but he notes the risk of contagion is huge. He says everyone must remain vigilant, especially as the pandemic has not stopped wars, pushing the number of forcibly displaced to nearly 80 million. He says the Central Sahel region in Africa is one of the most worrying political and humanitarian crises in the world, but notes there are many others. He cites new conflict-driven displacements in hot spots such as Mozambique, the recent clashes between Armenia and Azerbaijan, violence and human rights abuses in Nicaragua, and the situation in Yemen, where the fear of famine now looms large amidst the spread of COVID-19.
Governments around the world have taken tough measures to stop the spread of the coronavirus, often closing borders. Obviously, some restrictions are needed, but stopping the virus and offering protection must not be a zero-sum equation. Both are possible, and lives can be saved.
Grandi says more than 110 states have found ways to make asylum systems work while taking necessary health precautions. He says the UNHCR has helped countries protect refugees when large influxes occur. For example, he says Uganda, which hosts more than 1.4 million refugees, reopened its borders to allow entry to 3,000 people fleeing deadly armed conflict in DR Congo. He acknowledges the difficulties facing countries, but says closing the door to people fleeing war and persecution is not a solution.
People will continue to flee unless the root causes of their flight are solved. Reducing search and rescue capacity, or impeding those who engage to save others, or pushing back people without due process will not stop people from moving. It will only lead to more deaths and the further erosion of refugee protection.
High Commissioner Grandi says the global uncertainty posed by COVID-19 should not deter nations from seeking solutions to forced displacement. On the contrary, he says the pandemic should spur them on to help the most vulnerable in this time of greatest need. He says most refugees prefer to return home, but some simply cannot and will not. While they await solutions, he says refugees must be provided with educational, job, and other opportunities to make the most of their potential in countries of asylum. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
27 Americans known to have traveled to Iraq or Syria to join the Islamic State terror group are back on U.S. soil. 10 of them have either been charged or convicted of terrorism-related offenses. International Edition's Steve Miller gets details from VOA National Security correspondent Jeff Selden.
These are individuals who the Justice Department was able to gather evidence on, who have indications that they participated, trained with Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, took part either in fighting with Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. One of those charged is accused of being an ISIS emir at one point. Others took smaller roles, whether with logistics or with telecommunications, but they're all charged with attempting to provide or providing material support to the Islamic State. Those are the 10 that have been charged. There's another 17, and sources tell me that these other 17 are individuals who are connected. They're called by the U.S. government Islamic State affiliates. They're family members of the Islamic State fighters who are, in this case, American Islamic State fighters, most of whom have been charged. 15 of the 17 are still minors. They're children who have been repatriated and brought back. Two of the 17 left are now adults, but they were minors when their families brought them to Syria to join Islamic State.
Have any of the individuals who have been repatriated spoken out and given statements possibly to the media or other outlets as to why they chose to leave the United States and participate in activities by the Islamic State group?
They've talked variously about it. Some have talked more than others. For example, one of the very first cases and one of the very first convictions is an individual named Muhammad Jamal Qais, who as a young man traveled to Syria. He was convicted. He's from Alexandria, Virginia, just outside of D.C. And he talked about thinking it was a good idea at the time, but then realized it was a mistake and did what he said. He argued that he did what he could to leave, but still, given the evidence against him, he was convicted and sent to prison.
Now, we're talking about 17 individuals. Does this represent all the Americans that have left the United States to go fight with the Islamic State group, or does the Justice Department believe that there are more?
There are likely more Americans. Individual researchers, including those at George Washington University's program on extremism, say that if you add in Americans who have returned on their own from the Islamic State, the number of Americans charged with crimes is now at least 19. And these researchers say there's evidence that there are more Americans out there. It's just probably a matter of whether or not the Justice Department and U.S. officials can get enough evidence to bring them back through the repatriation process. The other wild card, the other variable, is that there may be Americans who went to join ISIS who are still there, but they're not being held by the SDF. They may be held by other entities, other groups, other nations, and there is not a repatriation process right now set up to deal with them, if they exist.
VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Seldon speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. Two Americans and a Briton won the 2020 Nobel Prize for Medicine on Monday for work in identifying the hepatitis C virus, which causes cirrhosis and liver cancer. The award-giving body said discoveries by scientists Harvey Alter, Charles Rice, and Michael Houghton meant there was now a chance for eradicating the hepatitis C virus. You're listening to International Edition.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOA's International Edition continues. The new horror film Antebellum by Gerard Bush and Christopher Renz is the latest of several black horror films addressing race relations in the United States. Filmmakers and critics weigh in on the film and what defines the black horror genre. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
There she is. Guess what? Daddy is going to get you dressed for school today.
In Antebellum, Veronica Henley, played by Janelle Monáe, is a self-assured academic and best-selling author who travels across America speaking about women's rights and racial inequality in the United States.
They're stuck in the past. We are the future.
A loving mother in an upper-class household, she feels secure in her world until all of a sudden she doesn't. Veronica gets kidnapped and transported to a Louisiana plantation recreated as a replica of one from the 1800s. There, along with a large number of other African Americans who have been abducted, she suffers atrocities. She's given a new name and she's forbidden to speak. Antebellum filmmaker Gerard Bush tells VOA that this horror story came to him in an actual nightmare.
And it felt like this woman was screaming across dimensions for help. That this needed to be told, that I needed to get the truth out. That is the only way I can describe it.
Film critic Tim Gordon acknowledges the power that slavery evokes in Antebellum and as a theme in the black horror film genre.
I thought 12 Years a Slave, which I think is probably the platinum level of this genre, which tells this story, kind of did an amazing job.
But Gordon says black horror should focus more on the African-American experience in a modern setting.
Because I don't really think you got to go far to find the horror in the culture. You just have to be very attentive and be able to articulate it to audiences. Whether it's just a little slice, as there's a scene in Antebellum where they're go to a restaurant and there's three of them and they try to seat them by the kitchen next to the dirty dishes.
Antebellum filmmaker Christopher Renz tells VOA that while his film focuses on slavery, its modern setting gives it a compelling twist. He says Jordan Peele's 2017 horror blockbuster, Get Out, where black people are held captive for medical experiments by white supremacists in today's America, set the stage for Antebellum.
I'm not sure if the reception would have been the same if Get Out had not happened and was not so successful.
Tim Gordon says Hollywood's embrace of black horror has helped it expand into streaming series, such as the Emmy-winning Watchmen, a fictional superhero drama based on a graphic novel where in an alternate universe, a female vigilante cop takes on white supremacists. And Lovecraft Country, a new HBO TV series that blends superhero, sci-fi, and horror genres set in the Jim Crow era.
Anything that Jordan Peele is producing and doing in Lovecraft Country, to me, are the epitomes of what this genre can be. And in both cases, they use just simple race in America and look at it and find the horrific elements to that.
Even so, film critic James Berardinelli says the topic of slavery remains central to the black film genre.
One of the most traumatic experiences for people of color in this country in the last 200 years is slavery and its aftermath.
Ultimately, says Berardinelli, like the Holocaust, slavery provides an inexhaustible supply of stories to be told in film. Antebellum filmmaker Christopher Renz agrees.
I think that everyone needs to constantly be reminded, and that's the only way that we will never forget and make sure that it never happens again. So I think there's room for a bunch of different stories. We're ready to tell a bunch of different stories.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And Bruce Springsteen is set to release a brand new rock album later this month, but with a little something extra. The Boss, as fans call him, will get to watch a documentary on the making of the music. Bruce Springsteen's Letter to You will offer performances from the E Street Band, in-studio footage, and never-before-seen material. The documentary will be released on Apple TV Plus on October 23rd, the same day the album Letter to You will also drop. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is targeting the corrupt investment practices used by the People's Republic of China to exploit the natural resources of nations around the globe, including in Cambodia. The U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated the Chinese state-owned entity Union Development Group, or UDG, for seizure and demolition of local Cambodians' land for the construction of the Dara Sakor Development Project. UDG was sanctioned pursuant to Executive Order 13818, which builds on and implements the Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act and targets perpetrators of serious human rights abuse and corruption and their supporters. Part of the land grant to UDG extends into Bodom Sakor National Park, a protected natural area that can only be handed over by Cambodian royal decree. In order to acquire the land, UDG registered itself as a Cambodian-owned company, headed by a Cambodian national. But within 3 years of receiving the land, UDG switched back to being a Chinese-owned and operated company without any repercussion. The People's Republic of China has used UDG's projects in Cambodia to advance its global ambitions. UDG-funded activities have forced Cambodians from their land and devastated the environment, hurting the livelihoods of local communities, all under the guise of converting Cambodia into a regional logistics hub and tourist destination. As is too often the case with Beijing's One Belt, One Road so-called development initiative, these activities have disproportionately benefited the PRC at the expense of the Cambodian people. In conjunction with a former Cambodian army official, Khun Kim, the Cambodian military cleared land for the Dara Sakor project by forceful means. Kim was instrumental in the UDG development and reaped significant financial benefit from his relationships with UDG. Cambodia's Council of Ministers ordered UDG to stop destroying villagers' property, but UDG ignored the directive and continued the destruction. Kim was previously designated by the U.S. for his role in corruption under the Global Magnitsky Sanctions Program in December 2019. The United States will continue to take steps to deter the PRC's exploitative investments in Cambodia and elsewhere, and to stand with its partners and allies in Southeast Asia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.